Rich Zeoli, weekday afternoons 3 to 7. Talk Radio 1210, WPHT, and on the free Odyssey app.
Dr. Wilfred Riley is the author of the book Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, Debunking the False Narratives Defining America's School Curricula. And he joins us now, as he does almost every week, and we're grateful to have him. Dr. Riley, how are you, buddy?
Doing really well. Good to be back on.
Well, listen, I'm happy you were here, and I also wanted to say that I think the sexual revolution was great for women. Or no, actually, I read in your book that's a lie.
Well, sexual revolution had some obvious upsides, I think. I mean, we both went to college, but I mean, yeah, the sexual revolution, one of the things I point out in the book is that, you know, a lot of things like, you know, oral sex became normalized for married couples, and so on, and there's obviously a plus to that, but STDs and a lot of those things really came out of the 1960s and 1970s. The gay party culture lifestyle came out of the 1960s and 1970s. Hippies came out of the 1960s and 1970s. So, I mean, one of the things we really did was kind of take a look at the rules that existed in society at that time. Basic rules like you should be clean and shave your body hair and all of that sort of stuff, and say, what if this was just made up by hateful, evil white men that wanted to restrain, you know, my natural impulse to be free? There was even a musical called Hair about how you shouldn't do all that stuff. And a lot of people took that really seriously, and that became kind of a plague on society. You know, the single mom came out of that era as well. And I think we're really, the street gangs came out of that era. I don't mean to just keep interrupting and saying Glenn Blake came out of that era, but we're still dealing with the effects of that now, that people took these things like male-female mating where you have three kids that go back to ancient Egypt, where guys and women have had the same gripes about each other. He drinks too much beer for 4,000 years. We took that and we said, what if we did something else? And we saw the results of doing something else, which are about 75% negative, and we're still living with them now. And that's something that I don't think we fully processed about the 60s yet. There's still a lot of nostalgia for the 60s, and I say in Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, look, a lot of this was terrible. Single motherhood was terrible, gangbanging was terrible, STDs were terrible, you know, the hippies were terrible, draft dodging was terrible.
Terrible. That's the word. That's terrible. The word of the day. Drink. If this was a drinking game, I'd be on the floor right now.
Yeah, it'd be like seven shots of just, you know, me yelling, terrible. Drink Russian vodka, because that's who inspired us to believe in this crap, the Ruskies. Bunch of communists, every one of them.
Well,
and there's some humor here. Like, we're both funny guys, but there really is an element of truth to that. There was another philosophy in the world at that time, red communism, and we were competing with it. And there really was this idea of free sex, Margaret Mead, free philosophy, Franz Boas, you know, free literature, Dostoevsky. Like, why not just reject that boring fence of Chesterton's that you Westerners, you Englishmen, you shopkeepers have always been so fond of? Why not try things our way, you know, the Russian way, the Prussian way? And we did it for a while, and we wound up with all this crap in our society that we're still today having to get rid of, that we're having to sweep back under the rug and into the closet. And I don't mean to make fun of it, but it was a social lesson. And I think it's one that's useful if we learn from it. I'm not sure we have.
I don't think we have, because I think that there's still this battle over saying that American culture and even, I mean, I hate to use the term family values, but I mean, that's still kind of a battle right now, right? I mean, you had the like J.D. Vance's comments about having a family, or Harrison Butker's comments about, you know, the fact that he was happy that his wife chose to be a stay-at-home mom and all the blowback he got for that. And then when there was an effort to try to cancel him from the Kansas City Chiefs, he's now the highest paid kicker in the NFL,
a little bit
more than our guy Jake Elliott here in Philly, but highest paid, $6.4 million a year. But there was an effort to try to get the guy fired just for daring to say that he's happy that his wife chose to be a mom and not have a job outside of the home besides being a mom. I mean, even just saying that in some way means that you are a horrible, terrible, no good, very bad person.
Well, I mean, I think that's crazy. So, like, gender roles exist for a reason. Gender roles exist for wolves. So, I mean, the basic gender role in nature is that they're obviously great female hunters and warriors. You know, if you look at wild bad dogs and big cats and so on. But it's very hard to provide, at least for predatory animals, because unlike plants, other animals move when you are pregnant or when you're nursing and you've just had kids. So when that happens, the males kind of take that over and they go out and hunt and provide, while the women, the females, take care of the young and raise them. And that takes years sometimes for other advanced creatures. So what humans do, that traditional man is the craftsman or something, and the woman runs the home, which is a position of great respect in most societies, that doesn't just go back thousands of years. That goes back to before we started using fire. So saying, well, I greatly respect business women, but I'd like my wife to take care of the house, and I'm a rich man, so I can afford that. I can afford a nice house for her to wife in, you know, and she's the home manager, and she takes our kids to sports, and she plans the menu, and she decorates for the seasons, and I'm not abusive. She has access to all my money, and I'm worth $6 million. You know, I don't think there's anything unusual about that at all. So, and I don't think anyone thinks there's anything unusual about that at all. About 60% of women say they'd prefer to be housewives if they had the choice. You know, I don't mean to just keep dropping stats. Between 26 yeah. and 43% of women are housewives. So what we see in society, and this occurs very often in terms of some of the conversations I have on social media about, you know, basic sexual expectations in relationships or basic financial expectations. You know, is it reasonable to expect your male partner to have a decent job? You know, is occasionally shouting abuse coming from an ethnic neighborhood? I think that there's reality, which almost everyone lives in. And then there's a take on reality that comes from a specific group of upper middle class people that don't much like the country, which isn't very effective and which almost no one takes seriously. This sort of spanking or timeouts for your kid is abuse sort of stuff, but which is really, really influential. And I don't really know what to say about that other than just sort of ignore it. But it's hard to ignore because it's everywhere. And a lot of the stuff that goes into it is really influenced by the narratives that I talk about in Blatant Plug, lies my liberal teacher told me. But good for Butker. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing evil about a man working and a woman staying home. That's the way families have worked forever. There's nothing evil about a man working and a woman working. I mean, that's another alternative that you've seen since Rome. But if you do that, you're going to have to come up with another way to run things. You're going to have to split chores 50-50 and so on. And it turns out a lot of people don't want to do that, and not just men. A lot of women don't think men are very good at childcare, for example.
We're not, by the way, we're not as good. I'm yeah, telling you that as a dad. I mean, I know that. I don't. And there's a reason why my 4-year-old daughter yells out for mommy at night and not for me. I mean, I just, and when I go in the room, she yells, I want mom. I mean, it's just, you know, and I think I'm a pretty good dad. Turning to the issue of crime, I wanted to ask you recently, the police chief, I don't know if you saw this or not, the police chief of Ferguson, Missouri, there was a cop who was attacked very badly. And this guy, and this chief, he comes out, black chief, comes out. And he says, like, what more do you people want? Like, we changed our uniforms. We've changed our policing. When does this stop? And that whole thing, of course, was built on a lie. But you could hear the frustration in this guy's voice. He was really at a point of just saying, enough is enough. And I think that the Michael Ferguson thing in Ferguson is another great example of kind of a narrative that was creative, right?
Yeah, well, the illusion is that the rioters want anything useful or coherent or that they have a point. So, like, and I think that this is the whole thing about a lot of this that a lot of people don't get. Like, there's no point that the rioters have. Like, there's no real argument that Palestine has in the Israel-Palestine conflict other than that Israel has from time to time committed war crimes. But, like, there's no argument that Palestine hasn't been offered peace deals. There's no argument that Palestine is well-led. There's no argument that Palestine would manage itself as a country. And it's the same thing with, like, black American activism most of the time. Like, there's no argument that interracial crime is mostly white on black. There's no argument that there haven't been a ton of concessions made. There's no argument that reparations in the form of affirmative action haven't already been paid. So it's just kind of endless complaining for the sake of complaining. So in the Ferguson case, like, the whole argument was that Michael Brown was this innocent black teenager, a gentle giant who'd been shot with his hands up by a racist cop. It turns out that he was a thug who'd committed a strong-arm robbery 40 minutes before this incident, who'd been shot with his hands out toward a cop's neck by a good cop who was a coach in the neighborhood because he's trying to take the guy's gun. Like, there was no case there in the first place. But this went on for 2 years. It almost destroyed hero lawman Darren Wilson's career. I think he's in, like, Sioux Falls in the Dakotas right now. And he finally found a policing job. And I'm sure he's happy to be there with his family, you know? Far from St. Louis. But in just a normal place. But so this, the riot broke out. It destroyed that pleasant city, 50-50, normal white guys, normal black guys. People were huddled in their businesses for a year. Everything's finally died down since then. It's just returned to being a normal community. But now there's a 10-year anniversary riot. That's why they're rioting.
A 10-year anniversary riot.
That's what it is. Google it. None of these people who are from this pleasant, integrated community, none of them, they're from St. Louis. They're coming back to riot because it's the 10-year anniversary of these riots, Rich, because we've seen this damned rioting for 10 years now. I guarantee you, I'm not making that up. So these people who aren't even from the city are back in the city because they've been rioting for 10 years in different places. They're traveling around the country rioting. So they don't know, probably, that the police have changed their gear and so on. And the cops are trying so hard. They've got different kinds of guns. They have service Glocks now. They've got different uniforms. They've changed out their police dogs. They thought German Shepherds were intimidating. But none of it matters because their opponents don't have a point. They're not good faith opponents. They're just criminals.
Let me, I'm going to grab this clip for you. So this is the chief, Ferguson Police Chief Troy Doyle, going off script at this afternoon's press conference, offers a passionate speech after the clash between police and protesters, leaves one of his officers with a severe brain injury and two others injured. And again, I point out now, you know, this is a black police chief. I think there's probably a lot of black cops on the force. That, by the way, Dr. Wilfred Riley is with me. He is the author of the book Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, which you should get. It's an outstanding book, debunking the false narratives, defining America's school curricula. This is the police chief of Ferguson. Take a listen. We're just loading it up here. Got it, Matt?
My team got out there and was assaulted by a number of the protesters that were out there on the scene. As a result, one of my police officers suffered a severe brain injury. He is at an area hospital right now, fighting for his life. And I'm going to break away a little bit from what I was planning to talk about. This police department, this Ferguson Police Department, since 2014, has been a punching bag for this community. The police department back in 2014, we don't even have them officers here anymore. So what are you protesting? These officers not even here no more. Everything that the activist community has advocated for, as far as body-worn cameras, implicit bias training, crisis intervention training, all this stuff. We have done all of this. What are we protesting? What is it? We even changed the uniforms at this police department because people said that the old uniforms trigger people. What are we doing? 10 years later, I got an officer fighting for his life. It's enough, and I'm done with it. We're not doing it here in Ferguson. Our community is united behind us. Our community is fed up. We want to heal. Our community want to heal. We want people to peacefully protest, but we damn sure ain't going to allow you to destroy this city, and we ain't going to allow you to hurt none of these police officers.
So I'm glad you clarified for us why they were rioting, because I had no idea that it was just simply because it was an anniversary riot, Dr. Riley. That's just, it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I don't think the officer necessarily knows that, because they replaced the old white chief, who was a good chief, with this new black chief, who's a good chief. I don't think the chief necessarily knows what's going on with this. But, I mean, so what he said there is actually really poignant, right? He says, okay, so, like, we tried to do what these guys requested, these students, I think he said at one point. You know, we did implicit bias training, we got the police body cameras, we did this other training. That was a little blurry in terms of me trying to hear it. And they're still not happy. I don't know why they're rioting. He's assuming that these are sort of good faith people that really correctly understand that there's a lot of violence between police and black people and want to stop it. But the problem is that there's not a lot of violence between police and black people. Like, the total number of unarmed brothers that were shot by police last year was, I think, 12. And these are just a bunch of thugs that are angry, that want to steal, in the case of many of the hangers-on. There's not a case there. And I'm saying this really bluntly, but it's real. We've put up with this for a decade now. So, like, implicit bias training doesn't do anything. There's virtually no chance that a bunch of middle-class black officers have a lot of implicit bias. Implicit bias is the idea that you can be subtly racist against a group of people, and that can be tracked by looking at how quickly you click on crayon drawings of faces of different races. Basically, I'm not making that up.
I had to do implicit bias training, and the first question was, I think it was, do you have unconscious bias? Yes or no? And I checked no, and I thought I was done. Boy, was I wrong. I had 45 minutes to go. I was just getting started.
Yeah, no, it is pretty funny. I mean, the other thing with implicit bias training is you can beat it just by taking the test twice from different computers. Like, once I realized that, like, they were saying I had a slight bias against, I think it was whites, and that was going to be bad for me as an executive, I just took it again, and I found out I didn't. But anyway, not even to make fun of this, it's this kind of stupid crap. Like, these are serving officers that are out there on the ground in Metro St. Louis that are wasting days doing this stuff. What's the other one? Body cameras. The body cameras thing is actually a very serious. It's so stupid that it's hard not to really come down to the side of the officers here. Police officers were harassed by community groups for years about wearing body cameras, and they didn't really want to because the body camera is a 3-pound high quality camera you have to lug around with you. It was just obvious there were going to be union disputes, civil rights actions, so on. The cops finally said, okay, we don't commit that many crimes. We'll wear the damn things, and we'll just not curse when we stop someone, no matter how appropriate it is. So they started wearing the body cameras, and what actually happened was that people behaved so crazily. This is true in black and poor white communities. When they encountered the police, that people started becoming sympathetic to the police. There's this whole genre of YouTube guys like Donut Operator that'll get these body camera videos when they become available 6 months after the release date and just run them so you can see what cops have to put up with every day. And now, people, civil rights activists want the cops to take the cameras off because people on juries are becoming more sympathetic to the cops, and people are arguing that's making them racist. So it's just like you can't please these activists. And it's really funny. Like, if you've ever seen Cop, it's just like everybody in the world acting a fool. It's like whites, ethnic whites, like Shirish guys, blacks, Hispanics. Like, there's an episode of Cops on an Indian reservation. So you can just imagine what the body camera videos look like. Like, some Indian guy with two whiskey bottles running. You know, so the police now are getting a lot of love from just ordinary citizens that are saying, my God, I didn't know it was that bad. So now they're going to take the body cameras off them. So this cop, that cop that you just heard freak out there, is just saying, like, for God's sake, for 10 years we've been listening to all this crap, and now they're rioting again. What more do you want? I'm with the cop.
Amazing stuff. Dr. Riley, I wanted to ask you, going back, you have a chapter in your book about the Southern strategy, and we've talked a little bit about this, you and I, this lie that the party's flipped. I was watching, Apple TV has a show called Manhunt, which is based on the book Manhunt, about the capture of John Wilkes Booth. And people don't realize that it was a conspiracy. Booth and his allies intended to kill members of Lincoln's cabinet, the vice president, Andrew Johnson. And they had help from financiers on Wall Street and the Confederate States of America. And there was this whole, you know, money line in Montreal and everything. But what I found fascinating about it is that, and I haven't finished the series yet. I love the book. The book was great. But the Reconstruction, post-Civil War Reconstruction, and the Republican Party and the efforts that they did to try to, you know, give black people who are now freed a chance, a fighting chance, and the efforts that the Democrats did to oppose that. And then when Reconstruction ended, and you had the birth of the KKK, and you write about this, and you had the basically a race war ensued in our country. But up until that point, you had a bunch of black black elected representatives and state legislatures, all Republican, of course. But I mean, this is a real thing that it gets whitewashed by history. I had a buddy once who made this great point. He said, you know, if aliens ever came down here and they looked at the party of why black voters are voting Democrat, considering that it was the Democrat party that fought for slavery and then opposed Reconstruction and then instituted Jim Crow, they would go, I don't like what, where did I land? What is this? What's happening here? How did we get to this place where that whole the Republican Party gets labeled as racist, considering that history?
Well, it's a really complex question. So, like, most things are not simple stories of good and evil. So, obviously, the Union Army conquered the South in the Civil War, and that basically, that is a story of good, although the average Confederate infantryman wasn't evil. But the Union Army was integrated. Blacks, Anglo-whites, Irishmen, whatever, Jews, came down from the North, overpowered the South, took the place over. Reconstruction was a period when black people and everyone else could vote in the South. Now, Southerners are still a little bitter about this today because obviously the South was treated as a conquered region. I mean, Northern troops of all colors swag around, freed slaves could vote, disenfranchised former Confederates couldn't. There was a fair amount of corruption. There'd been a lot of corruption in Confederate Southern politics. It was about doubled during this period. But, I mean, you definitely saw freedom. Now, when the Northern Army pulled out, that's when you saw the slow but real progression of Jim Crow. And the Ku Klux Klan in this period was the fighting arm of the Democratic Party, which basically beat the fighting arm of the Republican Party, which included a lot of armed black people. And yeah, you saw a near race war, and a lot of the legendary lynchings of history are part of this period. There were people killing each other. I mean, tens of thousands. So that's one of those interesting eras of history. There's actually a book called Negroes with Guns about this period that describes some pitched battles that have now been forgotten. I mean, it's not something you really want to talk about in the history of your city. You know, the town fathers are shooting at each other by the courthouse. So the modern image of the Republican Party as racist is actually pretty recent. The Republican Party was the party of black Southerners at least through the late 1930s, early 1940s, the Roosevelt era, when modern welfare and governmental spending began and the Roosevelt administration began to hire blacks. But the Southern strategy idea is the idea that when Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, black people who obviously supported the Civil Rights Act began to switch to the now liberal Democrats. The reality, just in a sentence, is that that didn't really happen. More Republicans than Democrats voted for the Civil Rights Act, especially in the North. Southern Republicans also voted for the Civil Rights Act more than Southern Democrats did. What actually moved people moved the South toward the Republican Party was just population change. Like, as air conditioning came to be invented, as cities grew in the South, a lot of young executives moved South, and that's the group that generally votes Republican. Like, you didn't see the South actually in Congress swing to the GOP until the 90s. So Bill Clinton won a substantial chunk of the South. So it's actually, I think that chapter is an interesting one, and it sort of breaks apart a lot of stereotypical narratives on both sides. But this is one of those media-driven stories where as soon as Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, Johnson obviously was the standard bearer for Kennedy, the sort of tall, beautiful representative of Camelot. The New York Times loved him. So from that point forward, Republicans, who were seen as a little rubish, a little Ronald Reagan-ish, every time they could be attacked on civil rights grounds, Ronald Reagan once spoke in Philadelphia, Mississippi, very near where a civil rights worker had been killed. Every time that attack could be launched, kind of from that point forward, it was. So in New York, in Chicago, in L.A., there came to be that association of the GOP with kind of country club racism, barroom racism, and a lot of that was unfair.
Yeah, it sounds like it to me. I mean, I'm glad to hear you say it was a media-driven narrative, because it really is amazing how they'll take a little tiny thing and twist it. I mean, they tried to turn Barry Goldwater into a racist. And again, our history forgets this, too. It was Woodrow Wilson, the worst president this country's ever had, worst two-term president anyway, who resegregated the military, right, and drove blacks out of government.
Yeah, well, Woodrow Wilson, I would agree, is the worst, at least prominent U.S. president. I mean, I guess you could go back to, like, Andrew Jackson, you know, killing Indians with his own hands in war and so on. But, like, yeah, Woodrow Wilson's a guy who watched and loved Birth of a Nation. If you want to talk about racism as a qualification for, you know, a poor quality president. Yeah, I think that the stereotyping of Republicans as bigots is generally pretty unfair. For whatever reason, I lost the train of thought there a little bit. But, like, to flip onto the Goldwater thing, Goldwater is kind of stereotyped as the guy who voted against or ran against the Civil Rights Act when he was running against Johnson. The reason for that isn't that Goldwater was a diehard racist. It's that Goldwater was a libertarian.
Right.
So Goldwater had actually supported previous Civil Rights Acts. But Goldwater actually made a very good point against the Civil Rights Act, and even as a black guy, I kind of agree with, which is that it really limited kind of freedom of association. That he wasn't just saying that in government jobs, you absolutely can't be racist. Military, you absolutely can't be racist. This Civil Rights Act actually extended that into all private business associations. So under American law now, you actually can't refuse to serve someone who's not just black, but female, gay, et cetera, in, for example, your private golf club. And the idea at the time among both white and black gentlemen was, well, no one would take it that far. But most prominent court cases recently, I mean, you have to bake the cake, is a joking line, have centered on people doing exactly that. So that was Goldwater's point. It wasn't any dislike of blacks or obviously of whites, of Gentiles or anything like that. It was just, what are we doing here? Are we prepared for the consequences? But because he said that, because he made that point in public, the Republicans have borne that label of you guys are the bigots ever since. And that was also attached to Reagan because he spoke in Philadelphia and so on down the line. Offhand, I don't know if Republicans, when you adjust for class and so on, are any more prejudiced than Democrats. But the party has been banned with that sort of brush for quite a long time.
Amazing stuff. Well, you can read more in the book, Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, Debunking the False Narratives, Defining America's School Curricula by Dr. Wilfred Riley. Always a pleasure, my friend. We're looking forward to doing our event together with you. The book is excellent. I just got a tweet. I'll just share it with you on the air. Our buddy Santo wrote, I love Wilfred Riley on the Rich Dioli Show. I just finished Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me. Great summer read. Amazing historical detail on issues plaguing our nation today. So summer read like chick lit. I don't think anyone's ever called your book summer reading like that. Like it's a nice beach read, but there you go. Look at that.
Yeah, we've got people out there relaxing near the volleyball court and reading like 290-page history books. That's the kind of top man you and I both attract. You love to see it.
That's what I'm talking about, my man. That's what I'm talking about. All right, buddy. Thank you so much. We'll be talking to you hopefully next Thursday live from the Democrat National Convention where I'll be doing my show because I lost a bet with God. So wish me luck.
Sounds good. Talk to you then.
All right.
It's the 5 o'clock happy hour on the Rich Dioli Show. Brought to you by the Oceanfront Grand Hotel of Cape May, New Jersey. A premier full-service resort and conference center. GrandHotelCapeMay.com.
All right. So, the Grand Hotel of Cape May, we do appreciate it. Just to remind you, Friday, September 6th, our next live show. We're going to be there for that, and it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. I hope you will join us for it. It'll be a fantastic time. Want to tell you, you know, if your bathroom in your home needs some updating, there's the company you should call is Emmons. Emmons remodeled our master bathroom in our old home, and they did a phenomenal job. Emmons has truly become your one-stop shop for home improvement. There's no question about it. Emmons is the real deal. And I trust the team at Emmons, and that's why just recently, Catherine, their design consultant, was over at our house giving us a beautiful orientation on what our new master bathroom is going to look like, thanks to the great redesign of Emmons. And you can have a bathroom, one that is truly yours, that you will love in as little as 3 days' time. 3 days. Isn't that amazing? 3 days' time to have a bathroom that you will love with little to no inconvenience to you and your family, because it's only going to be 3 days. Here's what you do. Go to callemmons.com, callemmons.com, or give them an actual call at 856-885-6677. 856-885-6677. you will find, just like I have found, the team is dedicated to your satisfaction and dedicated to making sure that you are happy. And a new bathroom in as little as 3 days' time? Unbelievable, right? Emmons serves our entire region, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, and the Jersey Shore. And since I've actually used them to remodel our bathroom, take it from me, they do a tremendous, tremendous job. Call Emmons.com. Call Emmons.com.
The Zioli Show on your schedule from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT in the free Odyssey app.
A-plus poll, Kamala up by five. First of all, this is Monmouth University poll. Monmouth University is such a disgrace, this poll, the poll there. It's such a disgrace. They were the ones who back in 2021, when His Royal Ruggedness King Philip the Unaccountable was up for re-election against Jack Cittirelli, they said that Murphy had a double-digit lead over Cittirelli. And Cittirelli almost defeated him in that election, but 400,000 Republicans stayed home because they thought that Murphy had it in the bag, that it was going to be a landslide. And then the polling director at Monmouth, Patrick Murray, came out and pushed an op-ed later on, basically saying he was like leaving the industry or whining about something like that. So now they have this poll from the same disgraceful Monmouth University polling, same guy, same thing, showing that Kamala has a lead. And I'm calling BS on this. I really am. I'm calling BS on this because the other part about this too is that they are, this poll is looking at, for example, voters from, it's national, and I've always told you, disregard national polls, number one. It's also registered voters, so I tell you to disregard registered voters, number two, because you've got to look at likely voters. And number three, because it's Monmouth University polling, and they have proven time and again to be nothing more than a tool for the Democrat Party. So a question that was asked to me recently, and it's a great question, our friend Kerry Nelson asked this, you know, when are polls used to influence public opinion versus actually read them? And there is a difference, no question about it. Polls like this, a lot of these national polls showing all this momentum around Kamala Harris, these polls are absolutely trying to push a narrative that Kamala Harris has this in the bag. But so don't believe them. Even CNN's top polling analyst, Harry Enten, said that you have to realize Trump is doing a lot better than polls indicate. And we're talking about Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. And when you look back, you go back to 2016, you go back to 2020, and how underestimated Trump was in 2016, for example, 5 points on average, which is basically where they're saying Kamala is now. Kamala has a 5-point advantage. And I've told you, I'm not worried about this. I don't think you should be. But I want to make this point, and I made it again. Don't follow national polls, and don't look at polls of registered voters, and don't look at polls done by the Monmouth University Institute of Polling, because they're BS. But here's CNN's top polling analyst, give you a little bit of comfort here, Harry Enten, cut two.
I want to take a step back and sort of point out we've kind of been here before. Mm-hmm. So August 13th, how far were the polls off in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin? And this is in 2016 and 2020. Trump was estimated both times around and by significant margins. Take a look here. In 2016, the average poll in those states that I mentioned, those Great Lake battleground states, Trump was underestimated by 9 points on average at this point in 2016. How about 2020? It wasn't a one-off. Look at this. He was underestimated by 5 points on average. And, of course, Kamala Harris's advantage in those New York Times, Siena College polls were 4 points in each of these key battleground states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. The bottom line is this. If you have any idea, if you're a Kamala Harris fan and you want to rip open the champagne bottle, pop that cork, do not do it. Donald Trump is very much in this race. If we have a polling shift like we've seen in prior years from now until the final result, Donald Trump would actually win. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I am saying that he is very much in this ballgame based upon where he is right now and compare that to where he was in prior years.
We certainly heard the Harris campaign saying we have to keep fighting.
Absolutely.
This is definitely not over. All right.
Yeah, it's definitely not over. No, it's not over. Not even close to being over, despite what the polling people say. One other thing that I want to mention is, you know, Trump has said this before. He becomes president, he's killing these offshore windmills, these massive wind turbines. You need to know that the Interior Department just announced the winners of its fifth offshore wind lease sale today. which resulted in $92.7 million in winning bids. One of them is a Norwegian energy company called Equinor Wind. They won one of the leases for these monstrosities, $75 million, which consists of 101 acres off the Delaware Bay, right in our backyard. Virginia Electric and Power Company, which is owned by Dominion Energy, won the other lease at $17 million, which spans 176,000 acres and is 35 miles from the Chesapeake Bay. And the Interior Secretary, Deb Haaland, said in a statement, at the start of the administration, our nation had approved zero offshore wind energy projects. Today we have nine, enough to power nearly 5 million homes. This is what developing a clean energy transition looks like. Now, this offshore wind, if Kamala Harris gets elected, you will see these massive turbines built. There's no question about it. You will see these massive turbines built. Trump gets in there. He's already said on day one he's going to kill him. One of the guys who is also working very hard to kill this is our buddy Jeff Van Drew, Congressman Jeff Van Drew. He's been working tirelessly on this. And I'm grateful, too. I think Van Drew is a fighter, and we're lucky to have him. But, you know, Van Drew, even last night, there was a forum, and he slammed New Jersey's offshore wind projects. He's not done, not letting up. With no letting up on his criticism, U.S. Representative Jeff Van Drew hosted his third public forum so far on the expansion of offshore wind on the Jersey Shore, joined by local officials, experts, community members. He said, quote, this is not the five windmills you see when you come into Atlantic City. We're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of wind turbines over 1,000 feet tall that have substances that can leach into our oceans. We are going to decimate our fishing industry, which is the third largest industry in the state. But these people don't care, the people being the Democrats. Community members at the event in Brigantine also voiced concern about noise and environmental impacts from wind turbines, and others said the cost will fall on taxpayers. They're going to cost you a lot of money, said Van Drew. Not a little bit, but multiple times. Your utility bills are going to go way up. I don't know about you, but the people I know have a hard time paying their current utility bills before paying all the things they need to. Yet he said time is growing short to stop the projects. We've got powerful forces against us. The current administration wants this no matter how much it takes, no matter how much it costs, no matter how much harm it does. This is not a partisan issue. It has nothing to do with loving our environment and loving our ocean. A coalition of eight Jersey Shore towns has gone to court to challenge the Atlantic Shores South project. This is from njspotlightnews.org. So the fight is still going. Make no mistake about it. The fight is still going. And this is the big story of the day brought to you by our buddy, Dr. Mike Vanaria, VanariaDental.com. Go see him today for your perfect smile, V-A-N-A-R-I-A, VanariaDental.com. And Democrats are so terrified that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is going to take votes away from Kamala Harris that they are fighting to stop him from being on the ballot. Now, just to remind you, yes, I was upset when I thought Joe Rogan endorsed him because the people that listen to Joe Rogan probably vote for Trump. So if they were diverted away from Trump, that would hurt Trump. But there's a whole other constituency of people that would vote for Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as an FU to Kamala Harris. And those are not people that listen to Joe Rogan's podcast. And those are the people the Democrats are trying to stop by keeping RFK Jr. off the ballot. So he was on with Sean Hannity last night talking about how the Democrats are trying to get him off the ballot in every state. By the way, the Green Party has won the right to be on the ballot in Nevada. So that's another opportunity for Democrats who are disaffected or don't like the fact that now they have a candidate who was never elected or never voted by a single Democrat. Not a single Democrat primary voter voted for Kamala Harris. They have options. And the Democrats are very concerned about this. This is what RFK Jr. said last night, cut three.
Yeah, I mean, I actually take more, slightly more votes from Donald Trump than from the Democratic Party, and Donald Trump, I've actually talked to him about it. He knows that. He has not tried to get me off of any ballots. The Democrats have tried to get me off the ballot in every state. Sean, I've done something that everybody said that I couldn't do. We now have enough signatures to get on the ballot in every state. And the District of Columbia, we have over a million signatures, more than any presidential candidate in history. They made it insurmountable, and yet we were able to achieve it. In New York State, you had to get 45,000 signatures. We got 150,000. The Democrats knew that, the DNC knew that they couldn't challenge my signatures. So they raised a frivolous issue saying I don't really live in New York State. Meanwhile, I vote in New York State. I've voted in New York State my entire life. I've never voted anywhere else. My driver's license is from New York. I pay taxes in New York. My law office, my only law office is New York.
Yes, there you go. There you go. They're trying to keep him off. It's just remarkable. I mean, they're terrified of the guy. They really are terrified. All right, I'm going to get into Tim Walz and this stolen valor stuff. There's more on this coming out. And now Walz is coming out and saying he's proud of his service. There's also a little bit of an update as well on the whole thing with the COVID snitch hotline. So I'm going to share that with you in the 6 o'clock hour. One good news, though, one good point that maybe some common sense is coming back, is that a major medical organization has broken with the consensus on quote unquote gender affirming care for minors. And that's the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, which represents 92% of all board certified American plastic surgeons, has broken with the general consensus, indicating it disagrees with gender affirming care for minors. Bravo. This is from the Daily Wire. Excellent stuff. They're saying that there is considerable uncertainty as to the long-term efficacy for the use of chest and genital surgical interventions, and that the existing evidence base is viewed as low quality slash low certainty. So they say, given the recent research and the revelations of the harmful approach advocated by people that are pushing this in the United States of America, we are now calling on this to immediately stop the promotion of social affirmation, puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and surgeries for children and adolescents who experience distress over their biological sex. Bravo. Well done. All right, listen, Cherry Hill Volvo on Route 70 in Cherry Hill, our great friends over there. How would you like to save $15,000 off the lease of an XC90 Volvo? That's the Volvo that I drive. It's the Zioli family car. You'd love it, and you should. Go see our friends at Cherry Hill Volvo, because relationships matter. Plus, they have a lot of pre-owned Volvos that are on sale at Cherry Hill Volvo as well. And remember, we broadcast live from the Cherry Hill Volvo studios. They stand with us every single step of the way, and I would love for you to go and visit them and say thank you to Judith for her incredible support of our station and our show. And $15,000 off the Volvo XC90, a beautiful, luxurious family car with that third row. And it's fast and it's safe with a super powerful engine. And it is the safest 7-passenger SUV on the road. But hey, if you want a smaller SUV, the XC40, the midsize XC60, my absolute favorite of all of the SUVs. Or if you want the sedan, you know, the S60, the S90, these gorgeous sedans are built right here in the United States of America. Either way, Cherry Hill Volvo is going to give you an incredible, incredible luxury buying experience, because they appreciate you. And that's why for generations, people keep going back to be customers for life at Cherry Hill Volvo. I'm one of them. I'm sold, because I appreciate the fact that they stand with us at Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. Remember, Cherry Hill Volvo is the region's most accessible Volvo dealership, minutes from the bridge on Route 70 in Cherry Hill, where relationships matter.
Rich Zioli, weekday afternoons, 3 to 7, Talk Radio 1210, WPHT, and on the free Odyssey app.